There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it.
There you go.
With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1092, April 28th, 2025. Steven.
This F1 Weekly podcast is brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads provide you, the F1Weekly.com web surfer, with ads that interest you. From tickets to the Canadian Grand Prix to ringtones for your cell phone, Yahoo Ads get you the stuff you really want. Click on them. You know you want to.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Yahoo Ads. On today's program, no Formula One this week, so we're going to do what Max Verstappen does, say as little as possible. I know nothing, I see nothing, I hear nothing. I do want to say the FIA has gone way too far. I think they're out of control, and I think Jean Todt's leadership is missed here. I'm not sure what Ben Sulayem is trying to do, but the drivers must feel terrible about it, and the GPDA seems to be powerless. So let's hope that George Russell can get this worked out and maybe get a little more respect, if you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, no race, that means more. Classic Nasser Hamid with another great interview. And this week is going to be Stirling Moss at his home in Florida. This is from 2009. I want you to enjoy this because it's really a wonderful, wonderful Nasser Hamid moment. And yes, we do need your contributions to keep this program up on the cloud. So please just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know, you'll want to. And there you have it. I want you guys to just enjoy this beautiful conversation between Stirling and Nasser. And Nasser, I do miss you every day.
In versatility and sheer talent, Stirling is the greatest racing driver Britain has ever produced. In his 16-year career, he did 529 races and won 212 of them, an incredible 40%. He'd race anything. Formula One, Formula Two, sports cars, GTs and saloons. They called him Mr. Motor Racing.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. This is a special edition interview with, of course, a legend of motorsports. And Nasser Hamid, who always gets the scoops here at F1 Weekly, has got a big one here. And I'm not even going to say the name, Nas, please.
Well, this conversation, an hour long, is with Sir Stirling Moss. Name says it all. And I would like to thank him very much for inviting me to his house and, you know, got to meet his wife and his son. And this interview took place near Fort Lauderdale in Florida. And what a conversation, you know. This gentleman has raced against and won against Fangio, Hawthorne, Peter Collins, a lot of history there. And, of course, still has a keen interest in Formula One and motorsports in general. So it was very nice sitting down and talking to legend of legends. So again, I hope our listeners enjoy the conversation, and my sincere thanks to Sir Stirling Moss.
Okay, folks, I'm here in Florida with legend of legends, Sir Stirling Moss. Sir, welcome to F1 Weekly. How are you today?
I'm very good, thanks. I'm sorry the sun isn't shining better, but we had nice weather here, and we're just relaxing, so that's good.
Is this where you reside mostly during wintertime?
No, I mean, this is a place we've got in America, in Florida here. And we come here whenever I've got anything to do over here. In other words, if I came over this time, Amelia Island, and I've got a thing with Mercedes at the weekend. And then, of course, later in the year, they've got Pebble Beach and Laguna Seca. So anytime we're going anywhere like that, somebody else is paying the bill, then we're here.
Now, you've raced in this country before, and we have quite a few good tracks here. What's your favorite track in the U.S.?
Well, you've got course circuits that didn't exist when I was here, but I think, frankly, probably my favorite was Laguna Seca. Riverside, Watkins Glen was not bad. I think they did actually have better circuits than the one I drove on. But I think I'd probably say Laguna Seca is the best, or Road America. You know, I don't really mind any. I prefer proper road circuits, because that you don't have many of those.
Now, as far as your racing history and life is concerned, you know, we have so much to talk about. Cars 722, Aintree 1955, Argentina 1958, and I can go on. What really comes to your mind first when you look back on your great career?
Well, I did 529 races, which is quite a lot. I mean, I was doing 50 races a year because I raced not only Formula 1, but Formula 2, sports cars, touring cars. You know, if it's got a steering wheel, I'll drive it. So, but I'm actually, I was brought up with, and I like most of all, racing on the roads. I like, obviously, the Mille Miglia. That is, in my mind, probably the greatest road race, with 1,000 miles all around Italy. The Targa Florio, very similar, but around Sicily. Then you get circuits like Nürburgring, which were really like a road, but they're not. It depends what one's thinking about, because when you're racing every single week, where you are makes a difference. I mean, the what the people are like and what the girls look like, you know, and all those sort of things matter quite a lot. So I would say that I enjoyed racing in Australasia very much. America was pretty good, but you didn't have many races that I could take part in here. I would love to have raced at Indy, but it wasn't feasible because, although my father did in 24-5, when I was racing, of course, Formula One cars were not sensible to take to Indianapolis, and therefore it would have meant coming over here, wasting a whole month of my time doing the rookie test and all that stuff on a totally different car, so it wasn't just a viable proposition.
Your dad, Alfred, raced at Indy and Brooklands. What is your earliest memory of motor racing?
My earliest memory really was, which of course I know happens, I can't say I remember it like yesterday. I was about 5 or 6 years old. My father took me to Brooklands, and of course when a car came in off the track, it was a practice. Being a kid, I ran across and leant in to look, see how fast it would go. And in those days, they had an outside exhaust pipe, which was bound with asbestos string. And of course, I'd put my stomach on it and burnt me like hell. And so that was my first recollection, I guess.
Well, you know, Brooklands, I'm a fan of motor racing history. I was there a few months ago. When was the last time you were at Brooklands?
Oh, I was at Brooklands, as you say, within the last couple of months. I mean, because they have quite a lot of things happening there now. Although it's not the Brooklands, of course, that was there before the war. I mean, the banking, there's a portion of the banking, but it's not used as a track. They've got a very nice infield and everything. It's very well done by Mercedes, but it isn't the same sort of thing that it was.
How old were you when you decided race car driving was better than being a dentist, which was your dad's profession?
Well, I couldn't qualify. I actually hadn't got. I wasn't smart enough to get my matriculation. So, therefore, I couldn't become a dentist, even if I wanted to. So, I was forced to go into something else, and I decided the hotel trade, or farming, or something or other. But I was about. I suppose that really, I didn't decide to go into motor racing until I was, I guess, 16. Yeah.
And my understanding is your parents were fairly supportive of your racing endeavors. Was the dangers of the sport a concern for them?
No, I had quite a lot of work to convince them, actually. It's danger. One of the things that interests a kid of 17, of course, is danger. I mean, I wanted to do something dangerous. That's what kids like to do, you know. And safety certainly was important. My father, I can remember him quite well, saying to me, okay, if you're going to race, you're going to wear a crash hat. And I said, oh, Dad, that's a bit sissy. I mean, the really top drivers like Chiron and Vimille and people like that, they didn't wear them. I mean, and Farina, they just wore a cloth hat. But anyway, he said, look, if you're going to race, you're going to wear a crash hat. But you see, when I started, the war had just finished, so there were no races in the way we know them now. There were mainly hill climbs and sprints, and then, of course, Goodwood was built, and we did have a few circuits. And I then, at the age of 18, signed up with a company called HWM and raced in Europe with a car, with that car. So that then took me out of England and gave me the fun of going all around Europe, being paid each week to enjoy myself, actually.
Okay, sir, you mentioned girls. Which European country or other part of the world has the best-looking girls?
Well, I mean, the thing is, they're what we call pit pops. It's a bit too crumpet in those days. I mean, they're pretty good selection anywhere, actually, I must say that. Australasia, I think, are probably pretty good. America, yeah, pretty good. And it's difficult to find somewhere where the girls weren't good, actually. So I wasn't... It was just part and parcel of the enjoyment. See, our quality of life in those days was far higher than the drivers today. I mean, they get paid a lot of money, but our quality of life, the enjoyment and the exhilaration and the danger and the whole vibration around motor racing was quite different. And it's something that, of course, will never come back. But running on roads, on the actual roads, you know, you go into small towns like they still do at Monaco, but we go into many, many towns like that, San Remo and Perigo and Mette and Erlen in Switzerland. So, and then they just put straw bales down and then you'd race. I mean, it was a fantastic life.
Would you have liked to see Kimi Raikkonen as your teammate in your racing days?
Yeah, I think Kimi's a good driver, but I don't know that he's a terribly interesting bloke to be going out with, actually, I'll tell you the truth, because I think he drinks a lot, and of course I didn't drink at all. I think I could think of better blokes to chase crumpet with, actually.
Okay, Bari 1951, you were to drive for Ferrari, but Enzo did an Italian job on you. Please tell our listeners about this experience.
Well, I mean, when you're, as I was then, 20 years old, 21, and you get a call from Ferrari saying, would you drive a car? You know, you cross yourself and face Modena. And, of course, I went down to, with my father, down to Bari in southern Italy, and I knew which car it would be because it was a new first four-cylinder Ferrari had done, you know, 12 cylinders. And I went to, found the garage, and went in there and saw the car and got in the car to feel it. And the mechanic said, you know, who are you? What are you doing? And I told him who I was. And what he said, oh, no, I'm sorry, you're not driving. This Piero Truffi is. Well, now, Truffi's a very good driver, but I was still pretty teed off. And I vowed then, I thought, well, if a man will do that, that's not, you know, not much of a gentleman. So I'll never race for him. And, in fact, I never did. But in 1961, just before I had my crash, I went down to see him. And he said, would I race for him the following year? And I said, yes, certainly. I will, a sports car, 246, and a Formula One car. And he said, you tell me what you want, and I'll build it. I said, well, all I want is one of each, and if you paint it in Rob Walker blue, Rob Walker being the man I race for, mm-hmm. I'll drive it. And he agreed, and the car was built. But, of course, I had a big shunt, and I was unconscious for a month and paralyzed for 6 months, so that finished it.
Mille Miglia 1955, classic European road race.
And here comes Moss, well out in front with the leaders. Ahead of them are 1,000 miles of some of the toughest racing in the world, right across Italy.
What do you remember most from this victory?
Well, Mille Miglia is something difficult to compare with others. I mean, there are 700 or 800 entries, and they reckon 15 million spectators all around Italy. I mean, the Italians love and you know, breathe, you know, motor racing, and it's a tremendously popular sport there. And I was driving a fantastic car, the 300 SLR Mercedes, which was capable. In fact, we were doing over 180 miles an hour, which was pretty quick then. And in fact, it was faster than twin-engined aircraft were, and on the roads. And of course, the biggest problem really is there are about 700 or 800 entries, and which means you've got seven or 800 drivers, or maybe even more, because some of them were sharing, and 1,000 people, in other words, driving. And really, I think about probably 15 of them were competent. You know, so it was a pretty, you know, pretty nerve-wracking experience, but. I mean, as an event, it is something quite unique. I mean, the people just line the roads. And the problem was, of course, I didn't know the circuit at all, so we made notes. But even having notes, which my co-driver, or at least my navigator, would give to me by hand signals, when you get people lining the roads literally round a corner, you can't see where the apex is. And, of course, that makes it quite difficult to drive. And so it does have its own problems. But and it's of course over 10 hours in length, and which is a long time. In fact, I said to Jenks, I'm going to have to stop. I mean, I can't hold, I can't not go to the toilet, you know. I mean, I had to have a pee, and we expected it to take about 10 or 12 hours. And so we did a stop when we were practicing. I said, right, okay, we're going to stop, and we're going to jump out and have a quick slash and get back in the car, which we did. But, you know, it takes a long time. You'd be amazed how long it takes, even if you've got your zip undone and everything else. So he said, all right, well, what we'll do is when we get to Rome, where we knew we had to have stop and we refuel the car and new tires and everything, we'll get out and do it there. Well, when we come into Rome, I didn't realize they'd built 75,000 grandstand seats. So, of course, one doesn't just jump out just like easily. So I had to run around underneath the stands. It actually took me 1 minute 4 seconds. I know that because that's how long we were stationary for. Well, they did all the work on the car and then jumped back in. But it's an event that I have very happy memories of, obviously, and very dramatic memories, because the speed differential between our car, which is about 180 or so, and the Isettas, which were like little eggs on wheels, which were tuned up, admittedly, they'd only do about probably 65 to 70. So, you know, you're going with a tremendous differential of speed. And, of course, diesels, I mean, people don't realise that the first car went at 9 o'clock at night, and at half-minute intervals thereon till midnight, these cars went every half minute. Then at midnight, the faster cars went, and that was at minute intervals. I went at 7:22 a.m., that's hence the number, and I wasn't the last car. So if you put all that together, you can see that awful lot of cars there, and the competence of the drivers, of course, was, you know, a bit suspect, as you can imagine. I mean, you've got the Italian hairdressers with go faster tape down the cars and all that sort of thing, and they just, you know, if you had a car, if you lived in Italy and you were a sporty sort of person, you had a car, you take it to Brescia, they put a number on it, and off you went. I mean, it's something you can't understand over here. Neither could we.
No, Dennis Jenkinson, what a great character. Any special memories of him you can share with us, please? And, you know, I'm so happy to tell you, in 1982, I was at Monza, and after the race, I bumped into him and had a, you know, minute chat with him.
Well, Jenks was a definite one-off. I mean, one story, which I think sums him up pretty well, actually. Alan Henry, a friend of his, went down for breakfast, and he said, look, come stay at my place, because the next day, that morning, they were announcing a new car in the nearby aerodrome. So he went down there, and he said he'd cook him breakfast, so he cooked him bacon and eggs or something, and Alan sat down, started to eat it, and he realised Jenks was over by the draining board and was eating his breakfast. He said, aren't you going to join me? And he said, I can't. He said, well, why not? He said, well, you've got the plate. I mean, if you can imagine, here's a guy living, you know, he only had one plate, there's only one person. And, you know, that was the sort of person that he was. And one other thing that came to my mind is, I said to Jenks when we were doing this thing, because we had this roller map thing, you know, which had all the notes on it for 17 metres long, and all the hints that he had to relay to me about the circuit, 1,000 miles, you see, because it would take 2 days to do one lap, you know, in practice, you can imagine. And we had this thing, and I said to Jenks, I said, you know, Jenks, what we should do, we should make 100 of these and sell them to the Americans. I'm sure the Americans would pay a lot of money for one of these. He said, no way, he said, if you want to do that, you can wait till I kick the bucket, and then you can make them. Well, anyway, many years later, my wife, we were down at Goodwood, and we were going to do a lap in the SLR with Jenks alongside me. And by then, Jenks was 80, 81 or 2, and, of course, couldn't jump around the way he used to, and we had the door open, he was clambering in and clutching this thing to him, and so Susie said to him, look, I'll hold that for you, Jenks, and give it to you when they're in the car. And he clasped it to his chest. He said, it isn't that I don't trust you, my dear, he said, but I know who trained you, because he knew very well I wanted to get hold of it to make some other ones, you see. But he was a weird man, a very amusing man, a very knowledgeable guy, and of course 3 times world champion in a sidecar, a man who didn't understand what fear was. And I mean, I did once say to him, look, Jenks, would you do the Mille Miglia with me in an MG? He said, good Lord, no. I said, why not? He said, I'd be scared. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I know how to drive an MG, and therefore I wouldn't agree with it. He said, but with the SLR, I know nothing about it, so I left it to you and I can enjoy it. I mean, you know, quite a weird person.
Yeah, great stories there. Okay, now, is it true that after the race, you started from Brescia, Rome, Brescia, you got into your Mercedes and drove all the way to Stuttgart?
Yeah, well, the thing you've got to realise, I don't know if you can buy it, but adrenaline doesn't half wake you up. And to go through that race, it was very tiring. I mean, you know, but I was very fit, of course. But to do the race over 10 hours, come in and then actually be found to be the winner, really gives you a tremendous lift. And I thought, well, you know, I can't go to sleep now. I'm just really too geared up. So I thought, well, okay, we'll drive back to Stuttgart because they want to see us and everything. And so I did, and drove through the night to Stuttgart. Yes, that is correct.
Was Jenks with you on this ride also?
I'm pretty sure he was. Okay. I must look it up actually in my diaries. But I'm pretty. I think he probably was. I'm pretty sure that he would have been. Yes.
Okay. Now, entry 1955, your first Grand Prix win on home soil, and talk about feeling high. How was this feeling, winning your first Grand Prix home soil over Juan Manuel Fangio, your teammate?
Well, I mean, you've got to understand that it was quite interesting. Actually, I did actually get fastest lap in practice, but Fangio, I think, was the greatest driver in the world. And I'm following him because the rules we had were team instructions which did not come into effect until when one Mercedes had 30 seconds lead, which of course in those days was possible, over the rest of the field. Then they put out a sign which said REG, which meant regulare. And so up until then it was open and any of the Mercedes could race against the other, they didn't mind. But once the REG went out, you'd hold position. And, of course, that didn't go out, and I was following Fangio. Then he got missed around by a back marker, and I nipped through. And it's 100 laps, because there were 3 hours in those days, remember, all Formula One races. And I nipped past him, and then I went as hard as I could. And he, of course, tucked in behind me and followed me the whole way. And then on the very, very last lap, I went into the last corner, braked very late, and as soon as I got round the corner, I pulled over to the right and waved him past with my foot flat on the floor, knowing jolly well he couldn't go by. And we finished up literally, you know, with 2 metres apart. And of course, it was a very, very important race for me. And I think whether he let me win or not, I don't know. I asked him. After we'd retired, I said, did you let me win? Because he's the sort of person that would have said, well, you know, good if Sterling wins this one because it's his own home place and I win the other ones and so on. But he said, no. He said, you were on form and it was your race. So I still don't really know.
You have been quoted as saying, and this is what really, it's like a wow, that I was privileged to finish second to Fangio. What made the maestro so good that even Mr. Motor Racing was happy to finish second behind him?
Difficult to tell you, because I could beat him in sports cars. He didn't, for whatever reason, didn't like sports cars. In fact, he really liked to see the front wheels, which I didn't understand. Didn't worry me, but he did. He had enormous tenacity. He was very fit, very strong. His driving, I mean, he would let me follow him. Literally, we were known as the train. I was only half a car length behind him for many, many Grand Prix. He'd never go over the edge and throw muck at me or anything, and he was just a real gentleman, and we had, an understanding or what have you. I mean, people would say, well, if you really tried, you could pass him. The thing is that, really, it's so much easier to follow somebody, and following Juan was, to me, the fact that you might beat him doesn't mean you're better than he is, and it was a great honour to follow the best man in the world, you know, that closely, actually.
So do you think it's a good idea for a young driver coming into, let's say, any form of racing? You know, let's just take the example of Alonso and Hamilton, that you team up with a really established driver, or it's better to just be with the back marker team so you get some experience. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm very lucky because I was brought up on hill climbs because racing didn't exist, as I said before. And the great thing about a hill climb is you set your own limit. In other words, you can't go into a corner and another guy come and pip you on the inside. You think, well, gosh, I should have gone deeper. Or you do the best you can, and all you're running against is a clock. Now, it's nothing like as exciting as racing, but I think it gives you a good background. And because I know that when I started to race, I really didn't spin a car for quite a long time because I was frightened it might turn over, which, of course, would be very unlikely, but nevertheless, I think that really, you learn a lot from other people, And there's now, of course, nowadays, you've got all these carts. Everybody comes through a cart. Well, of course, carts didn't exist then, so one had to come up in some other, fashion. But I think that a driver, is born, but then takes what is the talent he's got and polishes it to make it as good as he can. I think it's rather like somebody who's a singer. If you've got a good voice, and you're not necessarily a great singer, but you can improve it and work on it and get better. And I think motor racing has to be in that type of thing. I think that you have an aptitude, and then you learn so much. I mean, to brake really hard is quite difficult. I mean, that's where Lewis, for instance, is so good. He keeps the car under control. And people don't think of braking as being as difficult as it can be, actually. I mean, it's all road holding and so on, which does matter, but so does braking. But I think that if one can if you can learn, a car gives a driver a message. When you go with a car, you go into a corner, the car will say to you, look, if you go any faster than this, the front end's going to understeer or plough, as you call it, or the back end's going to oversteer or what have you, and you've got to get round that. So if you're asking it to do more than it wants to do, you've got to know what method of getting round. In other words, learn the language of the car.
Now, this feel of a racing car that most successful drivers talk about, you've pretty much answered the question, but I'll ask you in this way. Is this all natural, or this feel can be taught in a racing school, or can you learn?
I think a lot can be learnt. I think a good tutor really can help some people by pointing out, look, you might be quicker if you did this or that or what have you. I think that's to an extent, but I think it has to be a feeling that you've got. I always like to think cars have a language of their own, and each car has a different language, and you've got to learn what that language is and be able to speak to it. And so if you have driven, as I have, 84 different types of car, they're all different. They're all slightly, like women are different, but they're not completely different. And I think the interesting thing is you take a car which has a characteristic, and according to your, depending upon your ability, you can make that car the way you want it. In other words, with your mechanics, I mean, in my day, of course, you have to, you know, tire pressures and change roll bars and stuff. Now, of course, they plug in computers. I don't know what the hell they do, but they do. And you get the car so that the car will behave the way you want it. And very important, I mean, Sir Jack Brabham, who is a great competitor of mine, I know very well that if I drove his car and he drove mine, we'd have both been slower, because his characteristic and his demands on the car were quite different from the type of demands I would make. It doesn't mean he's better or worse, it's just a different way of going about it. Some people take a wide line around a corner, some, like myself, would take a narrow line. I would take a narrow line because I reckon I could brake deeper. And if you brake deep into a car, into a corner, and you've got your brakes, you're on the brakes or off the brakes, that can help you steer the car. And I think you learn these things. It's something you're not born with, but you just learn what they are and how you can get the handling characteristic to move from one car to another. They're all a bit different.
Fangio will always be the maestro. Since his days, we've seen a lot of drivers come, Jim the Clarks, the Stewarts, the Senas, the Prost, the Schumacher. Has anyone come close, in your opinion, to being the next maestro?
In Formula One, I think probably the guy who is nearest in my mind was Senna. But it's very difficult to compare. It's not really fair to compare a driver of the era of Nuvolari from before the war, or Fangio after the war, what I'd say were the dangerous years, to the safety years. Like now, I mean, the cars are so safe, which is fantastic. And I think the tragedy really is that Senna was killed really in a safe car. I mean, what happened, that the radius arm going through his helmet's a million to one chance. The fact they'd moved back the barrier so it would be safer, which of course wasn't, because he went straight into it head on instead of glancing off it. These are awful things that have happened they say because it's safer, but it isn't. I think that to the driver's mindset, when you get into a car and you go into a corner, say at 120, 130 miles an hour, and you think, God, if I make a mistake here, I could die, is quite different to, if I make a mistake here, it's going to ruin the race. And this is something that I'm glad that I was in there when it was dangerous, because to me the danger was the salt in the equation. You know, it gave the taste, it gave the flavour, it gave the fear. I mean, I certainly was scared at times. I mean, till the flag fell, the start flag. I mean, quite often one was slightly nervous. You know, I mean, you know, you're risking your neck today, and that is an exhilaration. It's also a dampener, and to have that with you, sitting on your shoulder all the time, is something that makes... It's rather like gambling with money or with chips. If you have a stack of chips, they don't mean anything. You can be foolhardy, but if it's money, you aren't. And if it's your life, what you're betting for with, that does bring it up to a pretty sharp end, you know.
1955, you won another great event of bygone era, the Targa Florio with Peter Collins in a Mercedes. What does this victory mean to you? And if you could talk a little bit about Peter Collins, please.
Well, the Targa Florio was a fantastic circuit. I mean, the big thing about the Targa was it was 44 miles a lap. And you could go down there, you could learn it. I mean, it'd take you, you know, a few weeks of going round and round and round. It took about an hour to do one lap, which is a hell of a lot less than the Mille Miglia, which was 2 days. So you could go there with a rental car and drive around for, say, 12, 15 hours a day, and you got to know it. So I did know the circuit, I think other drivers probably. I knew the surfaces, which was important, because in Sicily, when they want to repair a hole, they go and throw a bit of tar in it and put a bit of gravel on the top, and that's it, you know, so it doesn't really do much. But it was very, very... I mean, there was only one straight. All the rest of it was in the corners. It was a wonderful race. I mean, I had the pleasure of driving probably the finest Porsche ever built. I think it was an RSK or an RS60. I can't remember which it was, but absolutely fantastic. The car was so good. It was so light, so agile, and much easier to drive, say, than the SLR, which was a fabulous car in its own way. But the SLR was great for the Mille, whereas this Porsche was absolutely stunning for the demands of the Targa. And Peter Collins was one of my better friends.
We now continue with our conversation with Sir Stirling Moss.
Okay, now we go to 1958, opening round in Argentina, first ever win for a rear-engine car. Before the race, how convinced were you that this was going to work?
Well, we went there, and it was the first time actually a rear-engine car had won, so we had no experience. But the tire wear was very, very heavy. And I said to Alf, there's no way we can change a wheel because there were studs. I said, I'm going to have to, whatever I do, I'm going to have to somehow do this non-stop. And so we agreed, and I went round the night before saying to all the drivers, you know, it's all right for you. You've got cars, you just jack up the back, change the wheels and so on. I've got to have to waste 2 or 3 minutes to do that. And because they knew how bad the tire wear was. And, of course, at halfway, when the car started to go in for a tire change and refueling halfway through, my mechanic went out and stood there with a jack and a wheel to sort of say, okay, you know, in other words, he's standing by. And we parried out this charade for quite a few laps, and then it began to dawn on them maybe it wasn't going to stop. Well, by then I'd built up a sufficient lead, and the big problem I had was near the end, as the tyres wore, the front tyres, I could see them, they're right there. When you go through past the ordinary tread, you come onto the breaker strip, which is a white cloth thing inside. And when you go through to that, of course, it doesn't wear all together, so suddenly you get spots, white spots showing, and they're just in front of me, and these white spots started. And then, of course, as they wear more, then the white spot becomes a line. The line gets wider, and then you get to the breaker strip. Now, a breaker strip is a canvas. And, of course, I'm wearing the tyres. I'm going as easily as I can and dropping back and closing up on the fast cars when I can get behind one. But I was in the lead, so it wasn't that easy. And then when it starts to get past the white strip, then the hairs come up and it begins to get fuzzy. And so I'm watching these two tyres going around fuzzy. And it's quite nerve-wracking. I mean, I was... going around thinking, well, you know, here I was in this car leading a world championship race, a Grand Epreuve, first time ever for a rear engine car, and I'm in the lead. What am I going to do? I'm not going to go in and change and lose three minutes. So I just had to keep going, and I was going around. Luckily, at that autodrome in Argentina, the curbstones, you know where I mean at the side, they were chamfered. So I could actually go around them. I'd run up, and then I'd go onto the grass to cool the tyres down, then back onto the thing again. And so I managed to sort of save them. And anyway, in the end, they realised, and Musso was coming along fast as he could possibly go with the Ferrari. And anyway, he didn't quite make it. I won by about 2 seconds, so that was quite good.
A final race was in Casablanca, Morocco. A championship decider. You won the race and set the fastest lap, but Mike Hawthorn became the first British world champion with a little help from his teammate, Phil Hill. Can you share your thoughts on that day and evening, and did you feel anything bad about the team orders?
No, answering the team orders, not at all, because, I mean, obviously it was the right thing for Phil to do, was because at the time Mike had to win, I had to actually win, get fastest lap, and he not be second. Well, I was winning, I had got fastest lap, and he wasn't second. And then Phil Hill realised that he needed his space, and so he backed off, and correctly in my mind, gave it to Mike. I was obviously very disappointed, because I thought, well, I do deserve the world title and everything else, but I was disappointed. I got used to it after I lost it a few times, and now I'm in a situation where it doesn't worry me at all, frankly. When you're going around on these events, you get very consumed in them, and you know, you have to work out your own tactics and so on. And there was nothing I could do about it. I couldn't stop Phil backing off, and that sort of thing. So there it was.
Your teammate Stuart Lewis Evans was killed in this race, and Hawthorn himself was killed in a road accident a few months later. Can you share your thoughts on these gentlemen as drivers and friends, please?
I'll tell you, Stuart Lewis Evans was an incredibly fast driver. He wasn't very strong, and I think that was one of his problems, is fatigue would get to him a bit. But I mean, if you're talking about a driver getting as fast a lap as anybody, I would say he was equal to anybody in the world at that time. Tony Brooks was also with me in the same team, and he was another driver who I would say was as fast as anybody. I mean, the Van Wall team at that time with the three of us was I think really had fast drivers. And the car was not easy. It wasn't that pleasant to drive. The Van Wall was a beautiful-looking car, but it did improve. We had troubles with breakage of injector pipes and so on, so it had a checkered career, but the car was good enough to win the title, but it was never nice to drive like a 250F. But to see at the Italian Grand Prix, the last but one Grand Prix, I think it was, with the whole of our team in the front row was really very rewarding.
Now, 1958 was the first year of the Constructors' Championship, and Van Wall won that. Do you think Mr. Vanderwill would have stayed in Formula One had Stuart Lewis Evans not been killed?
That's a very interesting question. There's no doubt that he certainly did it because he was killed, yes. Whether he would have continued, possibly. Sponsorship and that sort of thing was much more difficult then. Of course, he was a rich man, but it's still a very expensive sport to run. I think with the team he had and the way the cars went, I think he probably would have stayed on, because he disliked Ferrari. He had big rows with him, and he said, one thing I want to do is beat those bloody red cars, you know. And I think that gave him a great reason for being in sport in racing. And I think probably if he hadn't got killed, yes, he probably would have stayed in.
You mentioned Maserati 250F. What a beautiful looking car. Was that the best car you ever raced, and any other cars that you were very fond of driving?
I would say the 250F was probably the nicest car, but you can't really compare it against, say the Mercedes, which won, of course, all the time. Mercedes didn't break. I mean, we had one complete failure at Monaco on the Desmond Browning valve, but all the other races, the team won. And you can't knock that. I mean, it's a fantastic car. They really were incredible organisation in every way. But having said that, the 250F was the nicest one to drive in Formula One, there's no doubt. Better than the Van Wall, or better than any other. I think the only car that would come close to it, certainly now, of course, is the P25 BRM. but then that's many years later with the development of modern knowledge and so on. So, but I would say that anybody who drives a 250F, even now, will get out and say, boy, that's a nice car. And don't forget the first 250F, which I bought one in 54, because that's what Neubauer suggested I did, was quite different to the lightweights and the Piccolos and so on of the latter years.
Neubauer, Alfred Neubauer, suggested you buy a Maserati.
My father and my manager went to see Alfred Neubauer in 1953 and said, we understand Mercedes is coming back next year, that's 54, will you give Sterling a tryout? And Neubauer said, look, he said, we've seen what Sterling drives, they're not very good cars, but he's done exceptionally well with them, but we'd like to see how good he could be in a competitive vehicle, and therefore if you can find something that was a bit better than the ones he's been in, which are, you know, not very good cars, that would be interesting. And so I went... Well, I didn't. My father and my manager went down, saw Maserati, negotiated a deal there, and I got my own 250F, and then we went to Bern, and that was really my lucky part. We went to Bern, which is a very difficult, dangerous circuit on the Bremgarten, and I managed to, in the first day it was wet, and I managed to put it on pole position in the wet, a private car, in front of Mercedes and Ferrari and everything else, and then Neubauer said, okay, well, we certainly will take you next year.
Wow. Monaco 1961, great win, but with bodywork missing.
And Moss is staying ahead. He's led since lap 12. A fantastic drive in a slower car against the might of three Ferraris. So, down to the Portier, Sterling Moss leading in the green Lotus.
Is it true this was done to provide what I would call natural air conditioning?
Oh, yeah, because the thing is, the aerodynamics don't really matter, or didn't at that time, because cars were much slower anyway, at Monaco. But when you've got 100 laps to do, and 14 gear changes every lap, it's pretty tiring, I can tell you. You know, it worked out at about nearly three and a half hours. And having the air moving around made a big difference. So I thought, well, right, well, we'll just take the sides off. The great thing about motor racing then was you could do these things. They'd come along and say, what are you doing? You'd explain, and they'd say, oh, all right, go ahead and do it. Now it's all a bit more red tape.
Yeah. Okay, racing drivers used to have a lot of fun together in the good old days. Please tell us about the party where a Hertz rental car was driven into a swimming pool, and who was the actual culprit?
Oh, gosh, that was one in America, yes. Hertz, I think it was Hertz, had just come out with a thing, rent from here and leave it there or something like that. And I think, I'm not sure, and I don't want to put wrong names for, but I have a feeling Augie Papps was in there somewhere. And a hire car had been, they took this car, which was at the hotel, and put it in the pond and said, well, we've got your car, but it's in the pond, in the swimming pool, I mean. But there was a whole crowd of people, and... at the time, it seemed very funny, actually.
You were there and they had the lights on in the swimming pool?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've seen funny things like that happen. I mean, I remember in the Isle of Man, a chap called Duncan Hamilton, who used to drink quite a bit, and they said they were going to get the police down. We put him down a manhole because he thought the police would put him inside because he'd had a bit too much to drink when he set fire to the swimming pool by putting the racing alcohol on it and then set fire. And so things do happen in racing, yeah.
Okay, now you know your 1962 Goodwood accident. I've heard you say that you were going to pass Graham Hill and he raised his hand. Did you ever talk to him afterward whether he was motioning you to go by or was he acknowledging the blue flags from the marshals?
No, the person, not Fangio, the person that I was catching up with was Hill.
Yeah, Graham Hill.
Graham Hill, sorry. I was nowhere near him. I mean, I was a lap behind. And I was coming up to where to unlap myself, and there was quite a reasonable space on the left, and I went to go past him, and my thoughts are probably that the marshals who were there put out a blue flag, which they often do, unwaved, sort of saying there's a car coming up, and I think I saw Graham probably acknowledge it, and I thought, well, he's obviously acknowledged that, and I was just going past him, and then he pulled over and. I think without knowing I was there, because he had a very wide entrance into this corner, and I don't think he realised I was there, and I had to go across onto the grass, and of course once I got on damp grass, that was it. So I don't really know. I think it's just one of those things you call a racing accident. It was certainly awful for me, because here I am at 32, and suddenly found I had to work for a living. I mean, that's not good news at all. I've been paid to do my enjoyment all the time up till then.
You know, I read something recently that this English singer, Leo Sayer, he was not only at that track, but was standing at the corner where you crashed. Have you ever talked to him, his recollections of that?
Not about that specifically, but I have spoken to him, of course, because he's very keen on cars and he's a great musician, and, you know, so we do know each other. But I haven't, now you've told me that, I will have a word with him when I next see him, see if he remembers anything.
Yeah, okay, that should be interesting, and I'll check back with you later what he has to say, if you don't mind. Yeah. Okay, let's take a look here, what we have here. You know, this is very interesting. We talk about racing has changed so much. I've seen a video of you pulling over, I believe at Sebring, getting a Coke from a flag race marshal, and there's a story of Stewart and Rind going to a drive-in movie on the eve of South African Grand Prix. Apart from the safety aspects in motor racing today, what are the changes that you like and what are the changes that you do not like?
I can't think of anything I like, to be honest, but I can see why we're at this place, because safety is important for the public, and therefore with cars of this speed potential that they've got to now, of course it's very difficult to be able to allow the public anywhere where they might be able to see the driver. I mean, the Coca-Cola thing I had was can't remember which year it was now, in the 50s, and it was jolly hot, and the guy sort of offered me a Coke, so it was like a Coke, I think, playing around. And I said yes, and he held it up, and I picked it from him and drank it, and then gave him the bottle back in case there was 10 cents on it, you know. But those things could happen, and they did happen in those days, and I think that can't come back, and I think that is one of the big problems, is motor racing is now such an incredible business that it's losing a lot of the humour, it's losing a lot of the enjoyment that the drivers have. I mean, a driver today can't have anything like the enjoyment that we had because it just isn't available. I mean, you just can't, it just isn't the freedom of, I mean, the thought of having a race like Italy, like the Emilia Emilia around Italy is unbelievable. You couldn't do that. I mean, it's just no way could you have people's lives at risk as they did then. Nowadays, because I think probably because in the early 50s, the war had only been over a short while and people accepted that people did die, from whatever cause. Now, of course, the fact that somebody might get killed is unacceptable to generally throughout.
Very true. Your sister Pat was also successful in motorsports and passed away recently. Can you please share some memories of growing up and going to not just car races but also horse show events, and both you and her competed, please?
Yeah, well, Pat and I, of course, she was 6 years younger than me, I think. And thank goodness she came along, because that took the pressure off me. My mother wanted me riding horses, which I did, and jumping, which, you know, I enjoyed to an extent. But then Pat, thank God, had a great aptitude for riding horses. And so that got my mother off my back, and I then managed to go into motor racing. So she did a great thing there. And I do remember Pat sort of said cars are smelly, oily things, and I said, no, you wait till you drive them. And then she did, and I remember going round Silverstone with her in an MG or a Healey, I think it was Healey, and I noticed she was lifting off really early on the straight, and so I said to her while we're going round, I said, look, next time I say to you stop, I want you to do a crash stop. Stop as quickly as you can. So we're going down the straight at Silverstone into a fast corner, and as soon as she lifted off, I said, stop, and she stopped, and long before the corner. And I said, well, what are you doing here? She said, well, you told me to stop. I said, yes, but I didn't tell you to stop until you lifted off. You should be flat out here. So then she got the idea of it, and then next time she left her foot in there, and no doubt that she had a great aptitude for driving, because, I mean, she won the Liège-Rome-Liège single-handed and so on, and she was really a very quick driver.
The meltdown we had at McLaren in 2007, what was your take on the Alonso-Hamilton-Dennis relationship, and what would you have done if you were in Ron's shoes?
Oh, very difficult, because I could feel for both, actually. Alonso was a terrific driver, world champion and so on, and then along came this guy, they said, well, he's a guy you'd never heard of, and suddenly a guy like Lewis Hamilton turns up and starts to, you know, be faster than you are. I mean, it's rather like, you know, saying to me, there's a guy that you don't know in Fangio who may come drive a car, and I'd been staggered. And I think it's a situation which wasn't handled as well as it might have been, But I suppose those sort of things are inevitable, really. When you've got so much talent, so young, and with so much experience, I mean, Lewis, the amount of experience Lewis has had in karts is enormous. I mean, really, it's absolutely enormous amount. And his I think his skill level is tremendously high as well. So I suppose if one was bright enough to see it coming, really.
All successful drivers have a love-hate relationship with fans. What's your take on Lewis? You know, some people say he's just a lucky guy, right team, right circumstances, spoon-fed success. You have raced and beaten the best, seen them all. How would you rate Lewis as a racing driver?
Oh, I think Lewis is exceptional, quite exceptional. I think he really is. I think he's not the only one. I think there are other guys there, Vettel and so on. I think, you know, Alonso and, you know, Kubica and so on. I think we've got some really good young talent coming now. There's no doubt that Lewis is in the right team, the right people. He's got Mercedes behind him. He's got a tremendous amount going. But then Fangio is much the same. I mean, Fangio drove the best cars. I mean, he was Alfa and then Ferrari and Maserati. And then, you know, these people. So when you're as good as they are, they obviously get the pick of the drives. I mean, you're not going to take some driver who's moderate and give him the very, very best car because he's moderate. You're going to obviously look to get the best you can. So then you get the two together, the best driver, the best car, then it's pretty difficult for anybody to beat them. So I can see how it happens, but I do think that Lewis is quite an exceptional driver. I think that he's probably as good as any of them, let's put it like that. I mean if I had to pick a team, obviously he'd be certainly one of my first choices, let's put it that way, if you could get him.
Let me ask you a question. If you had to take a second driver from all the drivers since the 50s, who would be your second pick?
Oh, Tony Brooks, without the slightest doubt. I mean, the best driver in the world who was not known by ordinary people was certainly Tony Brooks. I mean, Tony Brooks in sports cars would be as fast as Fangio. In Formula One, maybe not quite as fast, but right up there. And great tenacity and easy on the car. And I mean, he's a person who I don't think hardly anybody in America would know. But Tony Brooks really was a remarkably good driver. I would say if you want speed, you'd say Stewart Lewis Evans, but the speed, he hadn't got the strength to be able to keep it up, so therefore one obviously wouldn't take him. But if he'd been physically strong enough, then he would be another one. But he wasn't.
Global expansion of Formula One these days. No Grand Prix in the land of Fangio, Gurney, and Gilles Villeneuve, but we have races in Sepang, Malaysia, and Seoul pretty soon. Your thought on this trend?
What do you mean, the likelihood of being a driver from the East?
No, a trend that they're going to places where there really may not even be a big interest in motorsports, like in Sepang and places like Malaysia. And, you know, we don't have a race in Argentina, no in the U.S., no race in Canada.
Yeah. But you see, the problem with this really is that nowadays the only accepted circuit are these perfect in every way, man-made, fabricated circuits. Well, it's we've got there because of the way the sport is controlled, and it is a great shame to me, because I think that if it was proper road racing, you could have a good road in all sorts of countries, and it doesn't have to be that great. I mean, a car is made to go over manhole covers and tram lines if they're there, but of course it doesn't happen now, and you've got all these incredibly well places. They're terribly, to me, antiseptic, you know, but they are wonderfully done, and the toilet facilities are great and everything else, and you can't really knock it, I suppose. But it's not, to me personally, it is a shame that racing's gone that far in that direction.
You know, tram lines reminds me of Portuguese Grand Prix. In 1958, Mike Hawthorn was disqualified, I believe, from a race, Portuguese Grand Prix, and you came to his aid, which basically helped him get 7 points in second place, which cost you to lose the championship. Can you tell a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, well, they had disqualified him because he'd got up the escape road and then came the wrong way of the circuit, and the marshal push and so on. But from my point of view, and I said to him, look, he wasn't on the circuit, so he wasn't doing anything wrong. I mean, the guy's up the escape road, that doesn't count. Whatever you do up there, that's okay. And I'm glad to say they put him back, because I just don't believe that. To me, it's not. There's no benefit, no kudos, if you like, in winning a race if the person you're driving against has got a bad ankle and you're a runner, you know. And I think that in that case, I gave evidence on his behalf because I truly believe that he shouldn't have been disqualified. And yes, it did take away a world championship. But to me, the race that matters most is the race today. Not last week because we've done it. Not next week because we're not there. Today I may die, I may win. So I'm not interested in the trouble with the World Championship, which is very important, I understand that, is I have seen drivers, many drivers lately, only try to be a certain place to win the title. I remember Emerson Fittipaldi only tried to be fourth, I think, on the US Grand Prix many years ago because that gave him the title. And then last year we had Lewis. He only needed to be fifth and he got the title. That isn't, to me, motor racing. Motor racing is getting out there and having a go and trying to win. And but we can't change it. You can't make it the ideal way, can you?
Who do you like to see win this year's World Championship?
Well, I think I'd probably, Massa would be a very worthy champion because I think he did a tremendous job last year. He deserved, in my mind, he deserved the title because I do not believe that the team orders that McLaren gave to Lewis were correct. They said to Lewis they did not want him to go out and have a go. I think they should have let him, and I'm sure it would have been okay. And I think for that they should be penalised. I think if Massa wins, it'll be fair.
What's a day like in the life of Mr. Motor Racing these days?
Oh, I have a very interesting and enjoyable life. I travel a lot, a couple of 100,000 miles a year. I go around talking about motor racing, meeting people, and trying to put in my 2 cents with here and there, and they keep, you know, changing the rules, this, that, and the other. And I race historic cars. I've got a fantastic new Oscar, the FS372, which I've raced actually at Spa, and I hope to be racing that this year. I hope to race it in a Lola Mark 1 at Laguna. And so I look forward to taking part in rallies, which I drive with my wife, and just generally being on the fringe of it and enjoying it.
It's a great honor and pleasure to meet you. How about a message to listeners of F1 Weekly worldwide, please?
Well, all I can say is that try and learn. The more you can learn about the sport, the more interesting it becomes. When you know the difficulties that the teams are facing and the fact now we've got this Honda going so well, is it going to be that good? And, you know, the more you know, the more you glean from it, and the more exciting it becomes. Because motor racing is an exciting sport. I don't think it's as exciting now as it was, but then times have changed. And I think for excitement, sometimes there has to be danger. But having said that, I still think to be able to see the quality of drivers and the quality of the technicians and so on is really something worthwhile.
Thank you very much, sir.
So, Stirling Moss, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com.
Hi, I'm Joseph Newgarden, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
And here's your F1Weekly.com trivia question. Now, on my trivia podcast, question 5 is always a 5 for 5, where each of the 5 items have some common bond. So, here, now, I will name 5 drivers of the 80s, some of them with less than 40 races and some with few podiums, and you tell me what country they call or called home. Michele Alboreto, Eliseo Salazar, Johnny Cecotto, Hoob Rothengader, and Stefan Johansson. I'll have the answer toward the end of the podcast. How far is the moon from the Earth?
Interested in trivia? Please tune in to my Trivia Podcast, a weekly podcast rarely more than 8 minutes in duration, with 10 or more questions and answers of fun facts about topics such as science, geography, history, and there's even some audio thrown in. You can find my Trivia Podcast in iTunes, Podcast Alley, and other podcast sites, or you can go to www.mytriviapodcast.com. Hope to have you tuning in!
The moon is 250,000 miles away. The capital... Well, here's your F1Weekly.com trivia answer. Well, Michele Alboreto should be obviously Italy. Eliseo Salazar, Chile. Johnny Cecotto, Venezuela. Ub Rothengater, I'll take Holland, Netherlands, or Dutch. And Stefan Johansson, Sweden. So there's your answer.
And now let's go right to the wrap-up. San Francisco Formula One group. They meet, they drink, and they have a great time during the Formula One season. Check them out at sff1.com. Cameron Karting is proud to organize and support the 2011 Redline Oil Karting Championship. Cameron Karting offers CRG karts, engines and parts for all karts, engine service, driver coaching, and trackside support to Northern California karters. For more information, contact CameronKarting.com. I want to mention our Facebook and Twitter sites. Just do a search for F1 Weekly and make us a friend or simply like us. If you'd like to advertise or cross-promote with our website or podcast, email me at info@F1Weekly.com. I want to thank everybody who listens to the program. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.